welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, wherever you are in this wonderful world of ours. My name is Josh Haston. This is another edition of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. It is the 9th of January, 2017, Monday here in Jerusalem. I'm here on a very cold and chilly morning with my man Binyamin Bresky, engineer extraordinaire. It's a difficult day here in Israel. This morning and this afternoon, there are going to be four funerals taking place as a result of yesterday's jihadist attack that killed four IDF soldiers on the promenade here in Jerusalem, the Armon HaNatziv promenade. Four soldiers to be laid to rest throughout the day today: Yael Yekutiel, Shir Chajaj, Shir Atzur, and Erez Orbach. Hashem Yakom Damam. May God avenge their losses. Extremely difficult day. So many emotions from so many different places throughout the country. But I'm staring here at the front page of the Jerusalem Post with the truck used by the jihadist to ram down soldiers as they were standing outside their bus on the promenade. He ran them over, and then he kicked the truck into reverse and went back to finish the job to try to take out those who were still breathing. And that is just the sickness of the jihad, which we have seen here in Israel. And let's not say it's been a year or 2 years or 5 years or since 1967 or 1948. And this has been going on for over 100 years since Jews returned to Israel in mass and drained the swamps and made the deserts bloom. And others came along for economic and other opportunities, some with good intentions and others not willing to live with a Jewish presence in this region who are carrying out these attacks. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, along with the Defense Minister, Avigdor Lieberman, saying that this was an ISIS-inspired attack. I'm actually in a few minutes going to be speaking to a good friend, Dan Diker, the project director of the Program for Counter-Political Warfare at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. He's also the host of a show called Counter Terrorism Today on IDC International Radio. Good friend. We're going to be speaking to him about that subject. Was this an ISIS attack? And how do we know? How do we know this was ISIS? How do we know this wasn't Hamas? Or how do we know this wasn't just another Palestinian Authority, our peace partners in action carrying out this attack? The terrorist from here in Jerusalem, using an Israeli car with Israeli plates. We've seen this before. Not someone living in Judea and Samaria, not an Arab living in any of the areas next to what some would call settlements, what I call communities in Judea and Samaria, with Jerusalem, using his rights and his privileges and perhaps his citizenship, at least his identity card, to carry out this horrible, horrible attack. And here we are again. It's just a pattern that continues, and the waves, it goes up, it goes down, and four families are changed forever. And what will be the response? We'll ask Dan that as well. Will we see anything different? Again, asking the same questions over and over. It is, it's disturbing, it's disheartening, it's horrible. It's just an indescribable morning here in Jerusalem. But I just don't see an end in sight until we get serious. And it's a broken record because I've said it before and I'll say it again. I hope not. I hope not to have to say it again. But until we take some serious steps to thwart these attacks, it has to stop one day. One day it has to stop. Dividing Jerusalem's not the answer. Giving away land masses to our enemies in Fatah is not the answer. We saw the images last night of candy being passed out, not only in Hamas-controlled areas, but also within the Palestinian Authority. Celebrations in the terrorist's neighborhood, right next to Armon HaNatziv, Jabal Mukaber, last night, setting off fireworks. And this is the response. It's not everybody, of course. Not everyone supports this stuff. But enough to make an impact, enough to show that this is who we're dealing with. The prime minister saying today, being he was actually at the scene making some vague comments, not being clear as to what steps will be taken in response to this attack, sealing off the neighborhood, steps against the family, perhaps. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what the difference is going to be come today, tomorrow. I'm sorry for the pessimism, but it's hard as I'm staring at the faces of these young people in the front of the paper today. I blogged for the Times of Israel yesterday after watching the very disturbing video in which the attack occurred. Crystal clear, the truck running over the soldiers. Some soldiers who were there, there was a group, apparently a big group of soldiers on the scene. Some ran, 300, according to the Jerusalem Post, 300 soldiers in the area on educational trips to Jerusalem. Some ran to try to stop the terrorist. Others picked up their stuff and ran in the other direction. And the title of my column or blog, if you will, in the Times of Israel is, I don't blame the IDF soldiers for running. I've gotten mixed reviews. Some people have said they liked it. I've gotten some, I don't want to call it hate mail, but some people have disagreed with my premise here. And again, it's not a slight on the soldiers, in my opinion, who decided to run. I mean, fight or flight kicks in these situations. You would hope that the soldiers are trained to stay and to fight. From what I understand, you're talking about some of these soldiers who have never been in a situation like this, are not trained in a situation like this, and in no way, shape, or form am I blaming the soldiers. And that's the point of my column. Number one, not blaming those who decided to run and save themselves, although somebody may, in fact, point their finger. But I think it's deeper than that. I think it's deeper than the actual act of running. I want to know what went through their minds. If it was save myself, fine. If I'm going to open fire randomly, more people are going to get killed, that's fine. If it's I'm not trained, I don't know what to do, fine. As bad as that sounds. But my problem with what happened yesterday is if, in fact, any of the soldiers in those 5, 10, 15 seconds as they saw what was happening take place, if they said to themselves, if I respond too harshly, I will go to jail. I will be punished if I respond in a way that is not 100% by the book appropriate. If that was the thought, I can't confirm it. I wasn't there. There was a random letter written to 0404, or at least published on that Hebrew news website by one of the soldiers there, who said that he did not want to become the second Azaria, and he hesitated, should I shoot at the terrorist, should I not shoot at the terrorist? That's a letter that was written, an anonymous letter. Some people are questioning the validity of that letter. But if, in fact, the soldier came forward and said he had hesitation or doubt as to how to act because, not because of fight or flight, because of his process in that short time in which he said to himself, I will be in trouble if I use too much force, even though this is a live, clear, and present danger attack. If that is the thought, then there is something seriously wrong with the training, something wrong with the operational command, which is going into the soldiers' heads. And that is my question. That is my problem. And my personal experience, which backs the theory, and again, maybe it's apples and oranges, but in another situation when I personally was in, back in October 2015, when I was nearly lynched on the road to Jerusalem and another woman was beaten in her car by a gang of Arab jihadists who surrounded the road, stopped her, tried to pull her out of the car and beat her to death. In that situation, when the soldiers arrived and stood around looking for some direction, looking what to do with looks on their face, not of fear. I don't believe these soldiers are afraid. I think these are the toughest and bravest soldiers in the world, the IDF soldiers. But standing around as the Arabs were taunting and launching rocks down at them, waiting with faces of, call it, hesitation, perplexity, fear of being too forceful, that is what I saw. That's the impression I got. Not that they were afraid of the Arabs throwing rocks, not that they were afraid that they couldn't handle the situation, but being afraid of perhaps going to jail, doing the wrong thing. And this is long before the Azaria verdict. A lot of people are saying, don't bring Azaria into this. There's nothing to do with Azaria, even though the soldier who wrote that anonymous letter said that he did not want to be the second Azaria. Sergeant Elor Azaria, who was charged last week with manslaughter, and his sentencing is awaiting. People are even offended if you bring up Azaria in regard to what happened yesterday. You want to take that opinion? Fine, take that opinion. You want to say yesterday and Azaria are completely unconnected? Fine. But I'm talking about an event that happened a year and a half ago, more or less, in which I personally saw soldiers, not because they were afraid of the terrorists, because they seemed afraid to break protocol. And again, the Army has rules. You have to follow the rules. I'm saying there's something wrong with those rules when there's a clear and present danger, when terrorists just try to lynch a woman, try to murder her, pull her out of her car, maybe even kidnap her. Who knows? And they did not respond, in my opinion, in an appropriate and speedy manner in order to quell the situation with that look, that stone-cold look on their faces of, will I get in trouble if I act too harshly? Reports from yesterday indicating that some soldiers, even as the event was taking place, were trying to get approval. I can't confirm this. Trying to get approval from their commanders on the scene if they can, in fact, open fire on the terrorist in the truck. Can't confirm it. I heard those rumors. I don't know if they're true or not. I'm bringing them to you with a question mark. But either way, I believe something has to change. I read an article by good friend Ruthie Bloom in the Allgemeiner talking about certain policies that have been amended in regard to violence in Judea and Samaria. Something about a female terrorist that a soldier, and I don't have the details in front of me, a soldier shouldn't try to liquidate or take out the terrorist with his weapon, perhaps should resort to Krav Maga if it's a female Arab terrorist. Check out Ruthie Bloom's analysis on that on the Allgemeiner and see for yourselves how some of these policies, which leave the hands of the soldiers tied, could in fact bite us and are biting us, I believe. It's the old adage, if you're cruel to the kind and kind to the cruel, if you don't use the appropriate force when necessary, if you are afraid of going to jail, if you're afraid to act, hey, I'm afraid now if I have to use, that incident of mine back in October 2015 when I had to use my gun to save my life and fire in the air, and I had my gun taken away from me for a week, and I was left unprotected for a week because I was under the threat, I had my life threatened, and no other choice in my mind in those 5-10 seconds other than to fire in the air and scare off the mob. And I have to now think twice. And since then, I've been attacked with rocks. I have to think twice and think long and hard before considering going to the weapon again, unfortunately. If I'm attacked a third time, God forbid, hopefully I won't hesitate. But I've been attacked since, and the thought crosses your mind in those 5 seconds. Do I take that chance again that I'm going to be interrogated by the police? I'm going to be interrogated by the Shin Bet as I was. Yes, interrogated by the Shin Bet for self-defense, shooting in the air to disperse a mob. So that is the problem that I personally faced. And what about these soldiers who have to face these situations perhaps daily, whether it's in Judea and Samaria against rocks, firebombs, or in the case of yesterday's truck jihadist attack in Jerusalem? Again, we mourn for the victims. We pray for those still injured. There's still a group of, I think, about 10-plus soldiers in the hospital, some severely wounded, some lightly wounded. We pray for their speedy recovery. We pray that something like this doesn't happen again. And let's only hope for good news for the rest of the day and the rest of the week. Let's hope our leadership does what it has to do in order to prevent the next attack. And I know a lot of these attacks are prevented and are just not reported. I get that, and I appreciate that. And we all appreciate the work of our security forces who work 24/7 to thwart these attacks. I don't want our soldiers to question. There are ethics, there are morals, and I know I know our army is the most moral army in the world. I don't need to be shown that time and time again. I don't need any more proof. But I do need the soldiers to have in their minds the ability to react, to defend without fearing repercussions, even if there is, God forbid, a mistake. They should know automatically what they are able to do, and they should have the authority and the power to do what is necessary without fear of going to jail in order to prevent these types of attacks in the future. I'm going to take a break right now and come back with Dan Diker, good friend, to analyze yesterday's attack. My name is Josh Haston. This is Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. It is the 9th of January, 2017. Get in touch with me. Let me know your thoughts. Do you agree with me? Do you disagree? Josh at thelandofisrael.com. On Facebook, it's Joshua Haston. Plenty of people disagreeing with me this morning. That's fine. You can disagree. I don't mind. On Twitter, at Josh Haston. We'll take a short break for station identification and to thank our sponsors. This is Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Be right back.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
And we are back. Josh Haston here, Israel Uncensored, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Thanks so much for joining us. It is the 9th of January, 2017, and we are here in Israel today mourning the loss of four soldiers who were murdered yesterday in Jerusalem, run down by a jihadist driving a truck near the Arman HaNatziv promenade. Just a horrible day. The funeral is taking place today. But the prime minister showed up at the scene along with the defense minister, and he pointed the finger at ISIS for inspiring yesterday's attack, comparing it to the truck attack in Berlin and the one in France and the one in Nice not too long ago. Joining us to discuss this is our good friend Dan Diker, project director, the Program to Counter Political Warfare at Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs and host of Counterterrorism Today on IDC International Radio. Dan, welcome back to Israel Uncensored here, the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Thank you, Josh.
So, Dan, let's get right to it. Yesterday's horrific, murderous jihadist attack in Jerusalem, the prime minister shows up at the scene without giving too many details and points the finger at ISIS. My question for you is, why ISIS? We've had many other car ramming type attacks over the last 2 years. We have Hamas on our border here in Gaza and Hamas influence in the Palestinian Authority. We have Fatah. We have Al-Qaeda elements. We have so many other terror groups here. Why in this case, or how in this case, is the prime minister able to point and say this was an ISIS-inspired incident?
Well, the prime minister is wanted to create a point of reference here. I think it would be a very long reach to say that the prime minister and the intelligence agency had made some sort of assessment, because it was just minutes after the truck ramming attack occurred. What I think the prime minister was suggesting is that tactically, this fatal terror, horrific terror attack, reminded him and the world of two very recent attacks, one in Berlin and the other one in Nice, which were also truck ramming attacks. So he looked at he looked at the methodology and said, "My goodness, this reminds us of what happened in Europe." And I think that one of the points that can be made here is that terror is terror is terror, and this is in the context of a gruesome decision by the United Nations to delegitimize the connection between the nation of Israel and Jerusalem. And here you have a terrorist with all the rights of any other Israeli from a neighborhood in Jerusalem who apparently had been inspired, according to apparently initial report, by Salafist terrorist organizations. Now, having said that, what's been reported even this morning is that there was no known group affiliation for this particular individual, and that's what makes this type of terror analysis much more difficult. But I think that the prime minister was saying it happened in Europe, it happens here. It's not about territories, it's not about borders. This is about a murderous, radical, extremist ideology to kill Westerners and to kill Jews, and in fact to kill anyone that is not as radical as those terrorists who are carrying out these assaults.
So what you're saying is perhaps the prime minister doesn't know, or we don't know at this point, if ISIS actually directed this attack, but you're saying he was inspired on that type of ideology, rather. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Josh, what we do know is that there have been reports of ISIS leaflets being distributed in northern Jerusalem over the last year and a quarter. In the neighborhood of Beit Hanina, for example, you found there were those black ISIS flags and leaflets that were distributed, according to some reports, to frighten the Arab Christians living in those neighborhoods. It hasn't been confirmed that there is, even though the leaflets that were found and other indications were signed by ISIS in Palestine, it's still some question as to whether such an organization exists. But there have been, as we know, Josh, some Israeli Arabs and some Palestinians in the post June 4th, 1967 launch in the Palestinian Authority controlled areas that have gone to Syria with a connection to ISIS. So we know that there is some connection between Palestinians, Israeli Arabs, and this group called Daesh or ISIS, or some call it ISIL. But we don't know yesterday. There's nothing that's come out yet from an intelligence standpoint to say that this was positively ISIS. I do think the prime minister is known for making diplomatic points and security points and mixing them together. It's not to say that he was confused, but I think that it was clear that he was pointing out that terror is terror is terror. That was the point, in my assessment, of what the prime minister was saying. This was ideologically driven terror. This is not terrorism by socioeconomic deprivation. This is not terrorism over a Palestinian state, so-called. This is terror for ideological purposes, and it looked very similar to recent other terror attacks by ISIS in Europe.
So, Dan, let me ask you this, and we've been in this situation, I can't tell you how many times, dozens, 50, 100, or more, the day after one of these attacks, and we ask ourselves, and at least the community, the population here in Israel asks, what's next? What steps are the prime minister going to take, and the defense minister, and the security cabinet? What can it be done now, maybe differently, in lieu of this latest attack, to actually see change on the ground, to make a difference in this war against, whether it is Hamas, whether it is ISIS, against the jihadists or the extremists, whether they're in Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, in Gaza? What's going to change, do you believe, on the ground here in the days and weeks ahead as a direct result of this specific attack?
Well, I think there are certainly a number of things that can be done, both in the counterterrorism literature. There are more passive defensive measures that can take place, like physical barriers to terrorism, like the counterterrorism fence and wall that Israel has put up along the June 4th, 1967 lines, which is called the counterterrorism, anti-terrorism wall in some places, a fence in other places. And that has had a major effect in stopping suicide terrorism. But here you have another problem, Josh, and that is what they call individual terrorism, or some people have called it the terrorism of the knives, loosely put. And that means that over the last almost 2 years now, you have seen a rabid incitement to murder campaign undertaken by the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. in order to encourage and radicalize, young Palestinian men and women to carry out these types of attacks. And this makes this type of what they call a lone wolf phenomenon. It doesn't mean that they are not incited to murder by an organized attempt by the Palestinian Authority, which we believe, and according to our analyses here at the Jerusalem Center, is exactly what's going on. At the JCPA.org, we've come out with a major study called The Knife and the Message, which tracks the type of incitement to murder Israelis and murder Jews that has taken place over the last few years by the Palestinian Authority. We know that the Fatah conference, the sixth Fatah conference in 2009, talked about armed resistance, what they call armed resistance, which we in the West understand as terrorism against Israel. And we know that Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the PLO, the Fatah, and the Palestinian Authority, has advanced blood libels against the state of Israel in the UN itself, as well as to the European Union. One might remember the recent example where he received a standing ovation when he said that Israel engages in blood libels. He engaged in a blood libel against Israel, and talking about rabbis that engage in this type of murderous behavior. So we see this type of incitement to carry out terror attacks. It's very, very common. The second point, with this I'll end my answer here, is that the Palestinian Authority budgets more than $310 million a year officially in its official budget to finance terrorists and their families. So here you have a terror-supporting organization inciting to murder Jews and Israelis. And one wonders, this type of explosive environment, how these things don't happen every single day. That's number one. Number two, the thing that we've got to do, I think, in Israel, is to take much stronger deterrent active measures in order to make it completely an unviable, untenable option for people to carry out these terror attacks.
Yeah, and, that all that information that we have on Fatah, on the incitement, you're talking about not just Hamas, you're talking about the Palestinian Authority, whose Fatah party heads the Palestinian Authority, our supposed peace partners. Why on God's green earth would our prime minister say time and time again that he'd be willing to meet with Mahmoud Abbas, the very same person at the head of this incitement campaign, anywhere, anytime? I mean, haven't we proven time and time again who he really is? Haven't we seen his true colors? Why should the prime minister insist? Maybe it's for a public relations efforts to make Israel look like the good guy. Why even say publicly, Mahmoud Abbas, I will meet you anywhere, anytime to discuss peace, knowing full well, as you said, he is the champion of the blood libels against Jews, against Israelis, against the people of Israel. Why even mention his name in the conversation? Why deal with him?
Well, I'll tell you, Josh, it's a very important question that you ask. It's a political question.
Right.
My understanding is that our discussion is more of a counterterrorism discussion. But let me just say this. Mr. Netanyahu is just another one of four or five prime ministers that signed on to transform a terror reality into a diplomatic reality by dealing with the PLO and making them into a partner for peace. And they are really, in truth, from a terror counterterror point of view, we can define the PLO, the Fatah, which is, as you said, the main faction of the PLO, and the Palestinian Authority, which is sort of the internationally sanctioned government arm of the PLO, as a hybrid terror organization. The PLO is a hybrid terror organization, and the Palestinian Authority is an operative arm of that hybrid terror organization. That means that they carry out conventional terror attacks. And we know, according to the assessment that I've offered you, that the Palestinian Authority and the owned and operated, if you will, by the PLO, they legislate and finance terrorists and their families, as well as engage in incitement to murder, which is illegal under UN law, as well, and UN sanction, international law. But at the same time, Israel has been engaged with them for many, many years, and the international community has continues to legitimize the PLO, which we saw at the UN very recently when the United States, the Obama administration, refused to level a veto on a shameful and distorted, inaccurate, assaultative resolution against Israel's sovereignty, which they called an anti-settlement resolution, which in fact was an assault on Israel's sovereignty, and offered a tailwind, as Khaled Abu Tuame argues in a recent Gatestone piece, a tailwind for radical Islamic terror groups. And I think that is what we, you know, that is what we're seeing today, is a, the phenomenon of hybrid terror organizations like the PLO, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, which are continued to be supported and legitimized, validated by the West, and at the same time that they conduct terror operations with the other hand. So you can be bombed in the morning or knifed or driven over with a truck, and in the afternoon they have some, you know, they have sort of diplomatic abilities, and I think we're certainly seeing that with the PA and the PLO. I think what the prime minister might do, while offering to negotiate, which is sort of a corner that he's in diplomatically, is to point out that the PLO must change this terrorist motivated behavior and stop inciting to murder and stop inciting to terror and stop paying the terrorists, stop legislating in the official Palestinian Authority budgets hundreds of millions of dollars to support terrorists. This must stop. And there is a direct connection between the murderous terror attack that we saw yesterday in the eastern side of Jerusalem and this type of poisonous environmental behavior.
Well, I appreciate you answering taking that political question, going down the terror path. I appreciate that very much. But I also just want to conclude. I want to ask one final question, Dan. You mentioned before that Israel must take much stronger measures to deter these attacks. And again, from where you're sitting, from where I'm sitting, we're not in positions of making those calls militarily. We're not in the defense ministry. But what would you do? What are the steps that you would do based on your knowledge and your experience in the counterterror field? You mentioned building the security fence and the effectiveness in stopping the suicide bombings. It is much, much, much more difficult when somebody randomly runs a truck over people in a park. What would you do, Dan Diker, practically on the ground in order to try to increase the deterrence and to thwart these, if you want to call them lone wolf, and I don't really believe in that term because it's all inspired by the incitement, as you mentioned, what would you do practically on the ground to stop these attacks?
Well, Jeff, there are a number of things that can be done, and thank you for that question. It's an excellent question and something that we, all, those of us who are students of counterterrorism and think about these matters of national security, really have to think about from a policy standpoint every day and do everything we can to help advise the governments of Israel in terms of what to do, even though clearly we have wonderful and skilled counterterrorism operations and capabilities on the ground. But one thing that's very clear is that the vast majority of Arabs that live in metropolitan Jerusalem, that have all the rights that any other resident or citizen resident of Jerusalem or citizen of Israel has, including all the socioeconomic rights, are loyal to the state of Israel. They want to work. They want to enjoy their freedom to pray. They want to enjoy their freedom to move. And when one deterrent effect is to, first of all, arrest the people around the terrorists and take sanctions against the family. The culture, Arab culture, is clearly a family and clan culture. And in many cases, the families and clans know exactly what each one of them are doing at any particular time. It's not an individual in society the way we have it in the West. And therefore, there has to be a stopgap measure that is taken by the families of these terrorists. And they have to do things like warn the law enforcement authorities when there is odd behavior taking place, when there are abnormalities taking place. And I think that taking away citizenship and rights for these terrorists and those around them who in any way are supporting or assisting them will send a very strong message, because that is one of the greatest benefits in the Middle East, that our Arab fellow citizens have are the rights, and they also have responsibilities and they have privileges that any other citizen, and certainly residents of Israel, have, or their citizens that citizens have. And I think that there has to be a lot of pressure, quiet pressure, placed from within the Arab communities on young people, people that carry these things out. And I think that certainly can be done. It must be done. This has to be actively pursued, both from a law enforcement standpoint and from a cultural pressure standpoint from within the communities. And they can do it as long as it's quiet. And this is something that, that Israel ought very much to advance, a massive social and cultural pressure, family pressure against these types of individuals, certainly to supply intelligence to the law enforcement authorities in order that they, those families and friends around the terrorists, live their lives in freedom and security that they deserve.
Dan Diker, Project Director, Program to Counter Political Warfare at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, and host of Counterterrorism Today on IDC International Radio. Also a great friend on the air and off the air. I want to thank you so much for your expert analysis and your time today. And let's only hear good things. Let's hope some of these measures are going to be implemented here in the near future. And let's just have some peace and quiet here in Israel, Dan.
Absolutely. As they say in Hebrew, b'tzorot tovot, which means we should only know good news. And thank you for having me on your program, Josh.
Amen. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much. That's going to do it all for today, folks. Unfortunately, we don't have that much great news to report today because of the situation. Again, here in Israel, it is the 9th of January, 2017. The funeral is getting ready to take place here for the four young IDF soldiers who were murdered in cold blood yesterday in Jerusalem on the promenade. Just for being Israelis, just for being soldiers, just for being Jews here in Israel, unfortunately. Let's hope for some good news this week. A big shout out to Binyamin Bresky, our engineer extraordinaire. If you want to get in touch with me during the week, it's josh@thelandofisrael.com. On Facebook, it's Joshua Haston. On Twitter, at Josh Haston. The conversation is continuing. I see people who are pro my thoughts, against my thoughts. It's all fine. Let's keep it civil. Let's keep the conversation going. I appreciate it. And that's going to wrap it up from a very cold, blustery, and unfortunately sad Jerusalem here for the 9th of January. This is Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Between now and next week's show, everybody be safe.
Hi, this is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. You can hear a new show from me every Sunday, and every day of the week, shows from another one of my very talented fellow show hosts. Reach me, Eve@thelandofisrael.com, and keep listening, everybody. We love your feedback. The Land of Israel, coming at you every day, every week. That's the Land of Israel Network on thelandofisrael.com.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with HaYovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to HaYovel.com.